You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of July 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
This is, make no mistake, this is a repeal and a replace of Obamacare. Make no mistake about it.
Any senator who votes against starting debate is telling America that you're just fine with the Obamacare nightmare.
Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio and television and the internet. To hell with them.
The Trump administration's attempts to actually do anything continue to result in proverbial sound and fury signifying not much. My guests George Brock and John Everard will be discussing this and the day's other big stories, including further helpful bellicosity from Pyongyang, the continuing Trump-prompted renaissance in American journalism, and Mexico City's drastic attempts to discourage traffic. Is it an example worth following? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests are John Everard, former British ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea, and George Brock, professor of journalism at City University London, former journalist for The Observer and The Times. Welcome both. We will start in the United States. Yesterday, of course, we saw Senator John McCain, himself currently receiving doubtless excellent medical care for brain cancer, making to the Senate floor to cast what turned out to be a crucial vote enabling the process which will remove medical care from millions of his fellow citizens. McCain followed this up with a characteristically robust wigging of his fellow senators, admonishing, "We're getting nothing done." George, first of all, is that a point at which we should be grateful for small mercies, that the Trump administration is getting nothing done?
Yes, I think on balance we probably should. They are getting nothing done because Congress is in, and the Senate come to that, are in a sort of ambiguous state of not wishing to be in open opposition to Trump on a lot of things, but not actually wishing to pay the price for doing the really unpopular things that he often wishes to do. So there's a lot of stasis. His administration is arguing with itself. They're very badly distracted. And oddly enough, the Democrats are they're short of a leader. And all of that points in the same direction to not much going on.
John, do we need to actually quit assuming that these people have any idea what they're doing at all and just acknowledge that the Trump administration is, whatever else you may think of its intentions, just objectively incompetent?
Yes, objectively incompetent. I think we could probably have formed that conclusion quite safely some time ago. Incompetent in the most basic sense of the word. In the famous words of John McCain, "We're getting nothing done." He was speaking there about the Senate. But of course, the fact is that the administration hasn't yet delivered on anything. I mean, the attempt to repeal Obamacare, we could talk about for ages, but it's not looking good. I see we stopped talking altogether about walls around Mexico.
Progress is slow on that front, I understand.
Progress is very, very slow, like sort of glacial. And all the other great Trump campaign promises just ignored is all they can do to actually hold a meeting in the White House now, let alone to implement policy.
George, Donald Trump has attempted to do something today, as luck would have it, in a series of audacious punctuated blurts. He has attempted to ban transgender people from the military. Excitingly, it is the anniversary of Harry Truman's executive order desegregating the US military, 1948, if I recall rightly. Again, does Trump have any idea what he's doing? Is this just a massive distraction? Is he trying to create a fight where one doesn't really exist, etc., etc.? I mean, we always end up with the question of, like, what the hell is he doing and why? So basically, that's what I'm asking you.
What he's got addicted to is a system under which he does things which make people go, "Have you seen what he's done now?"
Yes,
three or four times a day. He did it in the campaign, and as it turns out, he governs in exactly the same way.
It is the one thing he has an unarguable talent for, is creating spectacle and creating media events.
Without question. And I would have thought in the case of transgender members of the American Armed Services, it would be exactly the same. It's almost certainly not legal under American law, I would have thought. And thus, it is very likely to go into the sand, just like a large number of other things. When Trump comes down, and I don't think he's going to make it to the end of his first term anything like, I think history is going to be fairly rough on the collection of supine dorks, otherwise known as the Republican Party, who failed to do much about him quickly enough.
John, to look more closely at this latest outburst of Trump's, it will affect hundreds, certainly, possibly thousands, I should think, of currently serving American personnel. It has already been slapped down by many on both sides of the aisle, noticeably former veterans in Congress, among them John McCain. Looking aside at what political tactics Trump might think he's enacting here, does the idea in and of itself make any sense at all? I can't claim my own experience of dealing with militaries to be scientific, but I have worked in situations where I have dealt with soldiers. I've interviewed many of them from armies from all over the world. Whenever this subject has come up about the gender, the sexual orientation, the race of their comrades, I've met remarkably few who care in the slightest.
Yes, that's been exactly my experience too. And I think that the military collectively, and probably not just the US military, the reaction to Trump's latest outburst will be the jaws will drop for all the wrong reasons. This is a thoroughly stupid thing to say. Illegal, probably, as George rightly points out. Certainly immoral. Why should Americans who happen to be transgender not be allowed to serve their country? And plain daft. The US military, like militaries across the world, struggles to recruit good people. If good people happen to be transgender, why should the US military not take advantage of their talents? And because of the kind of things that soldiers have to do, things like, you know, race and convictions and sexual orientations very quickly become irrelevant. Bonds of comradeship form amongst soldiers and of all countries, and you know, nobody really in combat is going to care whether the person next to you is transgender.
I wouldn't have thought so, no. George, look at McCain's original point about getting nothing done, and he said this in the context of a wider rant about the decline of bipartisan cooperation in American politics, which he has lived long enough to witness in real time. Is there any prospect of that being revived under this president?
I would have thought almost none at all. I don't think that that particular problem is confined to Trump either. I mean, bipartisanship has been falling apart before
Indeed,
Trump arrived on the scene.
It didn't just begin in January.
You can certainly argue that he's made it worse, but it certainly didn't begin then. But on the other hand, the Trump experience, when people look back on it, will have been so traumatic. Who knows? It might encourage bipartisanship again, at least up to a certain point.
I mean, that's just final thought on this, John. A possibly optimistic analysis. If this circus does continue much longer, might we see a point at which Democrats and Republicans kind of, I mean, call it Stockholm syndrome if you like, but start actually working with each other to try and get around the White House?
Yes, I think there's a reasonable hope for that. Firstly, McCain's speech was very warmly applauded. I mean, clearly it went down very well in the Senate. Secondly, there's that extraordinary, I wouldn't really call it a leak, but that conversation between two senators who didn't realize that the mics were on, talking about having to work together to get around Trump. Kind of just as a final thought, say that my favourite bit of Senator McCain's speech was where he said we should stop listening to all these loudmouths on the radio. Absolutely, I thought.
Well, let's move along now to John's former bailiwick of North Korea, which has made another of its regular and tedious threats to reduce the United States to a lake of fire and so forth. Specifically, the regime appears to have been exercised by the recent remarks of CIA Director Mike Pompeo, who expressed a not unreasonable desire to separate Kim Jong-un from his nuclear weapons. Pyongyang's response included the warning, should the US dare to show even the slightest sign of attempt to remove our supreme leadership, we will strike a merciless blow at the heart of the US with our powerful nuclear hammer honed and hardened over time. John, is the alliteration important? They've worked on that, haven't they?
They have. That's a very polished phrase. I think they should be rather proud of that. I mean, as North Korean rhetoric goes, that's top of the range.
Nuclear hammer honed and hardened.
Yes.
I quite like that.
Absolutely. I think that might sort of find its way into an article somewhere. But can they actually do it? Perhaps. I mean, we know that they have got an ICBM. They demonstrated that just the other week. The experts are still divided on whether they've got a nuclear device small enough to put on top of said ICBM. But the consensus seems to be growing that even if they haven't, they will have within maybe a year. It also shows two things about North Korea. Firstly, the deep paranoia. Remember that this is a country that is in the middle of a massive purge from a supposed assassination attempt on Kim Jong-un earlier this year. Whether or not there was any such attempt is almost secondary. All kinds of people have vanished in the way that only North Koreans can. Secondly, a complete lack of understanding of the way that America works. Pompeo, important though he is, does not actually make foreign policy on North Korea. He was shooting his mouth off. His remarks were unfortunate, to put it mildly. He was off message. But they haven't realised that what he says isn't the same as what, for example, Tillerson says.
They must know that, though.
That you think they understand the division of powers in the US? I doubt it.
Really? Okay. George, what do you make of the rhetoric? Because the thing about North Korean rhetoric, it is all a bit one note, isn't it? It is pretty much the same few phrases cut and pasted and delivered in the usual sort of shrill, hectoring tone. Is it all getting a bit the boy who cried, if not wolf, then the imminent nuclear destruction of the Western Hemisphere?
I think it's important to look at the facts and the timetable rather than the rhetoric. The timetable does tend to suggest that the window up to the point where the best guesstimates are that they will have something dangerous, that window is beginning to close. This is a really serious question. And, anybody in America, never mind whether they're paranoid or Donald Trump or an idiot or anything else, would be justified in being seriously anxious about this. What you have to do when you have a potential rogue state is try and give them a stake in something. Now, an enormous amount of thinking has been done, for example, in relation to Iran, which has also been very interested in nuclear weapons. John is really the expert on this, but North Korea's problem is it has a stake in very little. People keep suggesting that is China going to lean on it to stop? We have almost no idea. It's almost the only leverage that people can kind of invent to make it behave. That's why it's unpredictable and dangerous.
On the subject of China, John, there are recent reports that China has formed a new border defense brigade of the People's Liberation Army and expanded security along the border with North Korea. Is that necessarily significant?
Yes, it is. The situation hasn't been good for a long time. It's getting seriously bad. It's not just the latest North Korean threats, it's the international response to them. Not just by the United States, we've talked about that quite a lot on this program before, but by China, which is clearly getting very nervous and has evidently decided that it is not going to risk the United States launching a military strike on North Korea and finding China unprepared. It's not just the build-up of hardware, though that is significant, but the rhetoric that's coming out. There was an article by a senior retired general last week, I think it was, saying that if things go wrong in North Korea, China should move in quickly, occupy a large part of North Korea, seize the nuclear weapons, and make sure that China's interests are protected. Significantly, that was not censored. Normally, anything that off message is ripped off the internet immediately by the goblins sitting in the Zhongnanhai. Didn't happen. Somebody is either speaking closer to leadership thinking than we'd like to imagine, or has got protected. China is getting nervous. China has got face to preserve. China has got to get through a very sensitive leadership congress just in a few weeks' time. It can't afford anything to go wrong. And if there is an attempt by the United States to take out the North Korean nuclear capability before it gets really serious, then I think the Chinese counter-response might be devastating and the consequences could be really quite unpleasant.
George, you mentioned that contrast between North Korea and Iran, and there were similarities in that they were slightly varying levels of pariah state interested in the acquisition of nuclear weapons. And as you suggested, Iran was talked off the ledge in part by giving it a stake in the wider world. But there, of course, you run up against the other fundamental difference between Tehran and Pyongyang, that the Iranian regime, unpleasant and obnoxious though it may be in many respects, is not completely unreasonable and does appear to want some sort of engagement with the wider world. It doesn't want to be a pariah state. North Korea has never given much sense that it's terribly interested in any sort of outreach itself. What actual stake can you imaginably give them in the wider world?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to suggest that there was a stake they could be given. I think people have been thinking about that for half a century, and no one, and much more expert people than me, have failed to come up with an idea. What I meant was the only leverage, as opposed to, it's either a stake or it's leverage, is China. And John was discussing that just now. But it's extreme. It makes the situation extraordinarily sensitive to bring it to the point of asking China to apply pressure in a position in which they appear to be doing so at America's behest. That's never going to be easy.
I mean, John, I know
and they won't do it. I mean, they've said so almost in so many words. Yeah. They've complained about American sanctions, secondary sanctions on Chinese banks, saying that this is destroying US-China cooperation over North Korea. And over this year, we've seen that China simply non-implementation of agreed sanctions. China is not going to risk destabilizing North Korea at any time, and certainly not in the run-up to the Party Congress. North Korea knows that and knows it's safe.
John, you've said before that all the good options are gone where North Korea is concerned, but is there, just to go back to George's thought about them having a stake in the world, are there any plausible carrots that can be dangled in front of Pyongyang as opposed to the increasingly large sticks being waved at them?
Yes, the trouble is that we've dangled carrots, and indeed Pyongyang has munched up a few of those carrots and simply delivered nothing in return. One of the big ones would be a formal peace treaty to formally end the Korean War. Remember, it's actually technically still there. We don't have an armistice, not a peace treaty.
Well, indeed, the anniversary of the armistice, I believe, is tomorrow, isn't it?
And the North Koreans are busy moving missile launchers around. Watch this space. The other thing would be for the US, of course, to withdraw sanctions and to cease what North Korea calls its hostile policy towards North Korea. What that means seems to change over time. In its last definition, it was to remove the slightest possibility of a US nuclear strike on North Korea. At various points, it has seemed to mean complete denuclearization by the United States, which seems a little far-fetched.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, George Brock and John Everard. Coming up next, the latest on Donald Trump's inadvertent reinvigoration of America's liberal media.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are John Everard and George Brock. Now, Donald Trump, of course, campaigned on a platform of bringing back American jobs which had been rendered redundant or irrelevant by the march of technology. He may or may not yet succeed on such fronts as coal mining and automobile manufacture, but he has already done wonders for journalism. The failing New York Times has posted record subscription numbers during his term and a 21% rise in share price this year alone. And last week, the liberal-biased MSNBC became the number one cable network in primetime for the first time in its history. Good work, Agent Trump. George, first of all, some perspective, perhaps. That's 2.34 million people watching MSNBC ahead of Fox News on 2.25 million. So by my maths, that makes 320 million Americans who aren't watching either of them. Do we overestimate the influence of cable news?
You can overestimate the influence of almost any media anywhere now because everything is so fragmented compared to what it was 20 or 30 years ago. So none of them have big shares of anything. Almost nowhere in the developed world does that any longer happen. And they tend to live a bit off the past if they've existed in the past. So yes, you can exaggerate it. I'd also just say that I don't think you mentioned the New York Times there. Bear in mind the New York Times, even with this terrific fillip that it's been given by politics, is still making a large number of people redundant right now.
Indeed.
And they're doing that because the decline of its business model, nothing really to do with the journalism or the demand for it, it's to do with the business model, has gone on remorselessly declining, irrespective of what's going on in Washington.
Looking at Donald Trump and the media, though, John, he has obviously made baiting the media a motif of his campaign and of his presidency. But does he really genuinely hate it? Because he'd be lost without it, wouldn't he? The thing that appears to matter to him most is being on television, is being discussed, is being talked about?
I don't think it's so much that Trump hates the media. Trump loves the media when they say the right things, like Donald Trump, you are the greatest, Donald Trump, you won the election. What he hates is fake news. And fake news, for listeners who haven't been here before, is things that Donald Trump disagrees with. Things like, what were you talking about in 2016 with the Russians, and what happened to all your campaign promises? So it's specific bits of the media, specific things the media does that he really hates. And he clearly finds it emotionally very, very difficult to cope with being contradicted, which, of course, is what the media does for a living.
George, the Donald Trump campaign and the Donald Trump presidency has presented the media with a challenge, I think it's fair to say. How well, in general, do you think America's media has risen to it?
Pretty well, in general. I think that I would be more critical of broadcast media than I would of the online and print media, because I think the broadcast media has occasionally just been taken for suckers by clever campaigning by Trump, who was simply doing nothing but provoke, not adding anything to anybody's knowledge, not illuminating anything, just provoking a large amount of attention. And I think occasionally, particularly in the campaign rather than subsequently, the broadcasters got a bit taken in by that. But I don't really think the major established online and print outlets were, and there's been some terrific journalism done by the New York Times and the Washington Post. Funnily enough, the traditional brands we know from a long way back.
John, but there was a criticism, which I think was not unreasonable, made during the campaign that too much attention was being paid, especially by broadcast outlets, as George suggests, to Donald Trump, just because he was good at creating a spectacle. He was good at creating controversy. He was great box office. Is that still something? Well, I'll start that question again. How much harder is it for the media to address that now that he is president of the United States and you therefore can't ignore him? So it sounds there's an inbuilt absurdity to this question, but are we paying too much attention to him?
I think the balance is slowly getting right. I think that the criticisms leveled during the campaign were right. I mean, there's an obvious temptation to run with a hot story, and Donald Trump's tweets provided lots and lots of those. But two things. Firstly, the effect of the tweet, I think, is diminishing. Every time he puts out a new tweet, tried a new diversion tactic, you get diminishing returns. We've seen all this before, and bit by bit, the media, indeed, the electorate at large, is getting quite weary of all this. Secondly, I think we're seeing a lot of confusion in the conservative media. I mean, we're talking about this as if it's the story of the rise of quasi-liberal media like MSNBC and the success of the New York Times. I think it's much more the slow failure of outlets like Fox News. Fox News was looking for a feast when Hillary Clinton became president. Lots and lots of inquiries, lots and lots of scandals, the kind of things the conservative media really love to get their teeth into. Now it's finding itself having to defend an almost indefensible president. It's a very difficult wicket to hold, and there's deep discomfort in Fox Media, as you can see if you ever tune into it, and as reflected in falling ratings.
What have you made of those outlets that hooked themselves to Trump early on, George, like Fox, and I guess to a lesser extent like Breitbart and the crankier online ones? How are they doing with, as John suggests, being in the position I'm sure they didn't expect this time a year ago, of having to try and find a way to defend the idea that Donald Trump is somehow president?
It's an almost impossible task. It's the most devastating stuff is the stuff which is the simplest and the most factual. Go right back to the row about the inauguration and the size of the crowds. You know, I just think that
God, that seems like 20 years ago, not 6 months, doesn't it?
And fair enough that a lot has happened, but I my sense is that eroded a lot. That made a lot of people think this man isn't just a liar. Actually, he's a bit nuts. And that really does undermine a president. People expect politicians to lie. They expect them to persuade. They expect them to stretch the truth. But people who are deluded, that's a really different thing. And the inauguration picture row about how many people actually attended the inauguration or not, and it was pretty clear Trump's claims were wrong, that kind of thing, the most passionate supporter can't do anything about.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we shall park international politics and turn in a slightly different direction. Specifically, we will turn round in the circles familiar to listeners who've ever tried to park their car in a city centre. Lawmakers in Mexico City want to make this even more difficult. They have eliminated regulations which mandated a certain number of parking spaces with every new development. Instead of penalising those who build too few parking spaces, Mexico City will now issue fines to those developers which include too many parking spaces. The revenue will, in theory, be put towards improving transport services. I have not had the pleasure of visiting Mexico City. I am reliably informed that the traffic is astonishing. John, does this sound like a good idea to you?
Yes, it's a great idea. It's not a new idea. I mean, it may be in North America, but many European countries have had systems like this going for a long time. And the City of London has had for, I think, 20, 25 years now, had a simple system where you will not get a permit to establish any new parking spaces. And as every now and then parking spaces go because somebody's found a better use for them, you create a kind of a one-way street, and bit by bit, parking is squeezed out. In Berlin, there has not been a minimum requirement of parking spaces per house for a very, very long time. And I think a lot of Western Europeans would find the whole concept really quite strange. It's good to see the Mexico City has finally caught up.
George, what do you think? Is it the business of cities to be trying to dissuade their citizens from using cars?
Oh, yes. You can't manage modern cities in any other way. And you are going to have to take a view about land use, public transport and parking spaces. Is all part of that. The only thing I would say is every time they do something big in cities, sometimes they get it right, sometimes they get it wrong. The thing that cities need to do is to be flexible. You have to learn from what happens. You constantly get information you don't expect. More people use something than you expected. Fewer people use something else. The really great cities are the cities that can adapt and flex.
I mean, John, how drastic should cities get? And I guess if you're looking for starting somewhere like Mexico City, where the traffic is extraordinary, can they be what works better, a kind of incremental change so people get used to it, or something drastic and eye-catching akin to, for example, the congestion charge introduced in London a few years back now?
Many cities really don't have much of a choice. They are only a couple of percent below gridlock. A curious law of traffic is that a very small increase in traffic above a certain point brings the traffic speed right down to either a crawl or very frequently zero. And a lot of cities are in that position. You have, therefore, to take radical measures just to keep your city moving. You can't do it incrementally. You just don't have the time.
I see the limit in Mexico on car parking as a sign of something wider, which is the beginning of the end of the car era. I don't mean cars are going to disappear. I just mean the big everybody travelling by car era. I think we're beginning to see the end of that.
Well, which leads to the next question, I guess, John, which is, should cities need to think about the driverless vehicles of the future, which I suspect are not all that far away?
Yes, and there is no real indication that every city has done so. I mean, the technology experts are telling us that before very much longer, and we don't know how many years it'll be, but it's on the horizon, we are going to have probably electric rather than petrol-driven vehicles, which you will simply summon and which you then tell to take you to wherever you want to go and then leave them while they go and find somebody else. The whole idea of having your car, which sits in front of your house for most of the day while you're not driving it around, will start to look very, very, very quaint. And of course, there are bicycles to think about.
I have been a precursor of the modern electric car, which functions on a very limited route under Masdar City in Abu Dhabi. And I have to say, I can think of very few things I want more. The idea that you just press a button, one of these things turns up and takes you where you want to go, it would be amazing. George, just a final thought. What do cities need to get right before they start taking drastic action to stop people driving?
Well, public transport is the most obvious single answer to that. If you're going to have a large number of electric cars, you need a very well-judged power supply.
Well, on that thought, that brings us to the end of today's show. George Brock, John Everard, thank you both very much for joining us. Midori House today was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Hunter Childen. Our studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. There's more music next at 1900. It's The Entrepreneurs, followed by The Cinema Show. The Daily is back with more on the day's main stories at 2200. I'm back with more on Midori House tomorrow at 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening.